Well, I think it's 1:30, so can I just welcome everybody to today's teleclass, and it's entitled Linking Infection Control and Product Evaluation, a Necessity in the Era of Patient Safety. Today's healthcare delivery demands the use of a variety of invasive devices and other products which can put our patients at considerable risk of infection and other risks too. And we have a world-renowned expert really coming to speak to us today on this matter, and his name is Robert Garcia. He's the Assistant Director of Infection Control at Brookdale University Hospital Medical Center, and I'd like to invite him to present his teleclass presentation to us. Over to you, Robert.
Good morning, everyone. I should say good morning here, and I know most of you are now in afternoon time in Europe. Thank you so much for inviting me, Paul Weber. Let's begin the lecture because we have quite a number of material to go through. If you turn to the handout and we go to the second slide, essentially today in healthcare we are surrounded by products. That's what I call products everywhere. It's interesting how the frontline worker today many times has a tendency to kind of take whatever is available, and what we don't realize is that we need to have some kind of process in order to give the patient the very best product available, certainly at a cost-efficient price as well, and to have the frontline worker who is using the product on the patient to understand how to use that product, how best to provide that product to the patient in order to give it the maximum value of care for that individual. For example, today we also have these kinds of electronic dispensing machines that for products as well. And we have incredible amounts of things on the market in terms of wound care and needles and sharps and things that we use for medical devices, which have a direct effect on the outcome of many patients. On the next slide, we have two photographs showing products surrounding us in our emergency departments. And on the right-hand side, on crash carts, on code carts for emergency, are loaded with different kinds of products that we use for prepping the skin, for inserting catheters, for individual use by the practitioner, for barriers, et cetera, et cetera. And we have to have some kind of structure in order to provide what is best for the institution in terms of cost, but also try to enhance to the individual patient maybe some novel technologies that in the end actually save a great deal of money for the institution itself. On the next slide, we have a picture of a storeroom, and a storeroom loaded with supplies. And the question I always ask institution is, who has decided to bring these in a certain category? Has a facility had a centralized process on how to assess products, how to evaluate products, how to finally accept the products, distribute products, and who's it going to be used for what populations? If this is not the case, then unfortunately the people who are making these decisions may not be people who are clinically inclined, have clinical expertise, and therefore in the end we may have some negative outcomes on patients due to exactly what we're using on them. On the next slide we have a slide that says why evaluate products. Well, I guess I gave a little bit of that away. One is certainly the emphasis on controlling healthcare costs. We need to have a cost-efficient medical care by consumers. This is critical throughout the industrialized world now. In terms of controlling costs, at what price do we give the very best care to the consumer? Increasing supply costs have certainly been one of the greatest issues. The more that we buy, the more patients that we have, and the greater the cost for an individual item impacts on the bottom line for the institution. Here in the United States, one of the greatest movements, and certainly it's one that's been talked about throughout the world as well, is patient safety. How do we achieve the bottom line of what we would term to be patient safety? In other words, improving care for the patient to its maximum, to an outcome where we can say that the greatest number of people have been affected in a positive way. In the United States, we also have managed care and capitation limits for reimbursement. So in other words, when we do have expenditures, we only get a certain amount of money back. So if we are not doing the right thing for the patient, the most effective way, in particular for a large percentage of the cost, which is products for an institution, which may be 20-30% of an entire budget for a facility, we may be throwing dollars right out the window. Of course, the issue of nosocomial infections, and we'll look at that a little bit more in a few minutes, and the issue of liability. The court system in terms of lawyers digging into individual patients getting infections, and was it due because there was not a system of control for how we did certain procedures on a patient, what we used, et cetera, et cetera. The next slide shows us some information from the CDC NNIS system, which is the National Nosocomial Infection System in the United States, which has about 300 hospitals enrolled. Then they send the CDC information on hospital-acquired infections, as we better know them today. And one of the things, for example, this is one of the three major infections that are reported. So we can see here central line-associated BSR rates per different types of ICUs. And we'll notice, for example, medical ICU 3.9 at a 50th percentile, a rate of 3.9 per 1,000 catheter days. These are specifically related to a medical device that we call a central line, which comes in different forms for different purposes, and again, is associated directly with a negative outcome. Even patients who die as a result of having central lines inserted. Next page. Shows us a slide from the MMWR. Here is a report of a Pseudomonas bloodstream infection associated with a heparin saline flush. So the issue of products being contaminated is one which still exists in the world. We have to, as particularly from an infection control perspective, be readily involved in the process of how products are approved in a facility and how they are to be used. Next slide. As we all are familiar, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, has issued a variety of different guidelines that focus in on the prevention of different kinds of infections. And also specifically, for example, things like hand hygiene guidelines on how to properly conduct antisepsis of the skin prior to doing procedures on a patient. The reason for me bringing this up is because if you look very closely at many of these recommendations, many of them are relating to products and how products are used, what you should use, how you should use it, when you should use it. And here are a couple of examples. From the hand hygiene guideline, it tells us, observe proper hand hygiene procedures either by washing hands with conventional antiseptic containing soap and water or with waterless alcohol-based gels or foams. Disinfect skin with an appropriate antiseptic using 2% chlorhexidine. Use either sterile gauze or sterile transparent semi-permeable dressings. And we go on to look at things like peripheral venous catheters, the use of barriers when we're going to insert central lines, and these are rather extensive now. And in the United States, we have national initiatives to use things such as barriers in order to reduce the rate of bacteremia associated with central lines. On the next slide, I continue to show you some more examples, inline suction catheters, issues regarding oral hygiene programs, shower or bathing with an antiseptic agent prior to an operative procedure, using appropriate antiseptic agents for skin preparations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Next slide. Products and infection. It's estimated that greater than 50% of all products reviewed at a products evaluation committee have a related infection control issue. One of the things that I've always advocated, that if, number one, infection control does not participate in a facility's product evaluation committee, and there are many different names for these kinds of committees, but if they don't participate, it's a very, very good idea that they do, because they're going to add a very strong perspective on how products should be selected. If, for example, your facility does not have a product evaluation committee, then maybe there's an impetus for infection control to try to get the facility to form such a committee, because it's only benefiting the patient and essentially many times also benefiting the employee, because there are many products also that are purchased for the employee's use as well. In general, infection control-related products deal with creating barriers against killing or preventing organisms from entering a body site. Products used for sterility assurance, or devices used to administer medications and fluids, or to collect or transfer blood or body fluids. In the United States, and on the next slide, is the FDA definition of a medical device. A medical device is an instrument, apparatus, implement, machine, contrivance, implants, in vitro reagent, or other similar or related article, including a component part or accessory, which is, et cetera, et cetera. It says here, recognizing official national formulary, intended for use in a diagnosis of disease or other conditions, or in the cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in man or other animals, or intended to affect the structure or any function of the body of man or other animals, and which does not achieve any of its primary intended purposes through chemical action, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think many of us are going to actually remember this definition tomorrow, but certainly understand that this in the United States is very, very regulated. So there are instruments, medical devices, which are regulated by a national organization in order to try to achieve safety for the patient. On the next slide, is a medical device regulated? As I mentioned to you, certain medical devices require review by the FDA. In general, a device to be used on a person in a healthcare setting must have an initial manufacturer filing and what they call a 510K pre-market notification. In other words, the manufacturer has to submit very specific data in order for the FDA to approve the market to be sold in the United States. And in fact, many times, even medical devices or medical supplies that are purchased outside and of the United States, in other words, they're manufactured outside of the United States, need to be cleared in one way or another to be sold here in the United States. What is product evaluation? The process of appraisal that considers the value and significance of quality, cost, safety, and practitioner choice for product selection. Quality refers to the extent which the product performs its defined function. So this is one of the main criteria when we're talking about product evaluation. Efficacy refers to how effectively the product meets its specified function. It's not only necessarily but function, but is it going to be effective, for example, when we're talking about preventing infection? And this is where the infection control professional needs to get very involved, because we're talking about potentially reviewing studies that have been published in the literature, and these studies need to be summarized and referred to committee members so that they get a feel that this product has been proven in the literature to be effective, or at least hinting that it may be somewhat efficacious, and that the facility might decide to evaluate that for a certain period of time. Safety refers to a level of risk avoidance. And remember one thing, cost is not the price. Cost generally encompasses many different things, and that is not just the dollar amount. Serviceability refers to the ease of use and maintenance, user acceptability, and durability. And probably the bottom line is really serviceability, because if the end user, the person on the front line who is using the product, does not accept the product, does not find it to be easy to use, that product is probably going to fail, and they probably will not use it extensively as you've wanted, and maybe breaking techniques which may be against infection control practice. Systematic product review and value analysis. What are basic questions? In a value analysis, what the committee is trying to do is really address the following questions. Will the product improve the satisfaction of the patient or the product user? Will the treatment outcome of the patient be changed by using the product? Will the product alter practice or have an impact on clinical decisions related to patient care? Good value analysis requires accurate estimates of total costs, including not only purchase price, but the cost of labor, utilities, maintenance, etc. So, for example, when we're talking about items such as we're having changes for IV pumps, and we need IV lines that go along with that. What is the actual purchase price here? Are we leasing this kind of equipment as well? Does that roll into the price of these new IV kinds of lines? What kind of labor is involved? In other words, is there a change that now the frontline worker spends three times as much time in using this product as they did before, et cetera, et cetera? If a product is more expensive than one currently used, value analysis assists in determining the incremental cost of the product versus the expected benefit to the patient. In other words, incremental cost is the difference between what you're currently paying and what the additional cost is for buying this new product. And that's really a pivotal question today, because a lot of this novel technology is more expensive. So value analysis focuses on procedures rather than products. In other words, the overall universal picture. On the next slide, you have a fishbone diagram. And this is something that me and my staff had done a while ago in regard to identifying variables which affect the outcome of catheter-related bloodstream infection. And what we did was we tried to break out the different kinds of variables that would affect that outcome based on categories such as staff, behavior and practice, education, etc. But notice that in almost every kind of hospital-acquired infection, products and devices also should be addressed. So that is one of the main arms or branches of this fishbone diagram, because there are products that are going to be used which are going to directly affect the outcome of infection. Product standardization eliminates duplication, it reduces inventory, sets and encourages a procedure standard, reduces educational needs for the staff, and results in enhanced patient safety if the decision process is ideal. Remember today, the norm must be standardization. We can't allow, for example, one physician to be prepping a patient in one fashion using one kind of a prep solution and have someone else use something entirely different in a different procedure, because essentially what we're having then is two levels of care. That should not be allowed to happen. Standardization should take into account what is best for the patient on a universal basis. Are you able to use that product for all adults, for example, all adult patients? Are we talking about neonatal patients? We need to standardize, for example, the kinds of catheters that are used specifically for them for a specific procedure, rather than having two or three different things that are going to have different levels of knowledge for the staff, different costs, different inventory levels, et cetera, et cetera. A product evaluation committee should be multidisciplinary, reports to administration, establishes subcommittees, maybe on specific product lines, monthly meetings to ensure timeliness, and establish timelines themselves. The timeline should be as short as possible in order to do an evaluation, get it back to the committee for review of those results, and eventually a decision for approval. Multidisciplinary. I won't read this entire list on the next slide in regards to who should be on the committee, but one of the things that is required under the United States OSHA bloodborne pathogen regulation is the requirement that end users be involved in the process when you're going to select things such as safety sharps, safety needles, etc., which is widespread in the United States. The reason for that is because the end user obviously is the one who's going to be using it on patients, and they should be having the input back to the people that eventually make the overall decision as to whether that was an acceptable product for them to use, whether they felt that that would reduce additional needle sticks, et cetera, et cetera. There is a handout that if you do not have, I believe Paul Weber will be sending you a handout. It's a 16-page handout that is a recommended step-by-step protocol for evaluating infection control-related products, and it is a supplement to this lecture. We don't have time to go through all of those specific points, but on the next slide, it will tell you those seven different steps involving product evaluation. And again, one of the things that I always emphasize is making sure that that all products are reviewed in a universal fashion, and that a product evaluation, a trial, is actually done, whether you do it on a specific patient unit or among a specific group of individuals in the institution, and that those results of that evaluation are documented on some kind of form, listing criteria for that product so that it is as biased as possible, and that it compares the evaluation of that product to the current product that you're using, if there is a current product. That way, you can make a decision as to whether you are actually going or potentially improving the system itself, either for the protection of the employee or for the benefit of patient safety. The next slide shows you some of the regulatory agencies involved in the United States that would impact on product evaluation. And they are fairly extensive, some of them that we've already covered. One of them, of course, is my own organization, the Association of Professionals in Infection Control, APIC. But we have federal regulators who are surveyors of quality, for example, Joint Commission. In the United States, we have the OR people, the AORN. We have the medical instrumentation people, the AAMI. And we go on and on with so many individuals. And in other countries, you may have, for example, state or local governments which get themselves involved in terms of impacting your decisions on what products may be used or how they could be used or when they should be used. The next slide is some of the contributions by infection control. Infection control should be involved because they review the supportive science, either the published data, what is best practice, policies and procedures that are currently in the institution, their own experiences in the field. They can confer with colleagues in their own field as to what kind of products are being used specifically for a procedure and whether they've been effective. And the review, of course, of outcome data. No one else but an infection control professional could really gather all this data and provide that to a committee which reviews products for use on patients. Okay, let's take a look at some particular products and services that are on the market today, and we'll have some insight into some of the things that maybe we should all be looking into. The practice arena for interventional epidemiologists, which is a theory that I wrote a number of years ago, really is telling us that in today's modern healthcare world, and this is in regardless as to what country we're practicing in, we live not only in a world of clinical practice. In other words, this is where we were, how we were basically trained, at least how I was trained starting out about 25 years ago. But the point is that the world has changed to one where the financial world is also impacting specifically. We only have X number of dollars to work with, and many times we don't get reimbursed if we have such negative outcomes as infections, which may occur as a result of using medical devices. And, of course, the issue of customer satisfaction. In other words, has the patient been infection-free or free of negative occurrences after they entered the institution, and how that eventually impacts that patient returning to the institution, or how it affects the decision of his family to use that institution again. So all of these things are critical for us to understand. The first example I have for you today is on hand washing. One of the things that we have to decide is when we're buying hand washing products, are we buying the products or are we buying a system? And many of the companies today which sell us hand washing products attempt to buy us, to sell us a system. And this is very, very important because one of the most important things we have to understand about companies that sell us products is what kind of additional value are they giving us? In other words, are they giving us support in terms of education, in terms of educating the staff that are going to be using these products? In the United States, it has become extremely important for us to emphasize to the staff the importance of washing their hands on a routine basis. And it's done either with soap and water, as you can see, with a waterless alcohol-based hand sanitizer, as recommended by the CDC, and the use of a hand lotion in order to keep their skin intact and avoid bacterial growth on the hands. So when we look at these kinds of programs, it is incredibly important to understand what kind of support do they offer. On the next slide is a HCPAC recommendation on performance indicators. Periodically monitor and record adherence as the number of hand hygiene episodes performed by personnel, number of hand hygiene opportunities by water service. Provide feedback to personnel regarding their performance. Monitor the volume of alcohol-based hand rubs or detergent used for hand washing or hand antisepsis used per 1,000 patient days. Now, HCPAC is the group from the CDC, which has written many of the guidelines that we're familiar with. And how do we go about implementing this? Well, if these companies that sell us hand washing products assist us in this product in this process, that is very much of a plus. For example, there is one company out there that has a program called Partners in Your Care. And what they attempt to do is they give you a program in order to try to increase employee hand washing. And they try to do this on a unit basis, on the patient unit basis. Now, studies that have been published by Marianne McGuckin have shown that this kind of program can increase hand washing by 34%. And we all know that hand washing is very much associated with the avoidance of healthcare-associated infections. On the next page, you see a copy of a brochure that is part of this program. And this brochure is part of the program, which is patient-centered. In other words, this brochure is part of the notification to the patient of telling them that what is required is that they should be asking an employee, have you washed your hands prior to coming to do a procedure on me? Now, it sounds kind of in your face, very straightforward, but this has been proven to be very effective in a number of institutions in the United States, and currently we are at the Brookdale University Medical Center participating in this program, and so far it's worked out fairly decently, but it's very early in the stages for us right now. On the next page, you can see that they give you actual hand hygiene usage graphs. So in other words, for a specific floor, for example, this one, 4 South, what they do is you're required to collect the containers for the hand washing soap or the waterless soap, the alcohol-based soap, and you count them up, and then they put it into a formula which multiplies the milliliters and estimates the number of milliliters used per hand wash and gives you this calculation. So you could see for this unit, over a period of time, the hand washing did increase significantly, and that's what you really want to do. So when the patient is requesting that employees wash their hands, it appears that that could be a very important program to alleviate a situation of increasing compliance. On the next slide, we have chlorhexidine skin antisepsis. Well, actually, the United States has been actually fairly behind most of the other industrialized countries in terms of using chlorhexidine. And chlorhexidine is a very, very well-known skin antisepsis and very well-studied. On the next slide, you'll see some of the results of those studies by Dr. Mackey at the University of Wisconsin, which shows clearly that chlorhexidine-based antiseptics reduce the number of both catheter-related septicemia or bloodstream infections and the number of contaminated isolates that are identified from a number of patients in this study. So clearly we have information. We don't need to really prove again that chlorhexidine is effective. And we go on to showing, again, more studies showing the effectiveness of chlorhexidine in 8 randomized controlled trials published in the literature. Chlorhexidine in the United States now is FDA approved and comes in a variety of different configurations for application. And it is now under some of the national initiatives, such as the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, something that is advocated to use 2% chlorhexidine prior to the insertion of catheters. So this is something that is, once again, something that we need to bring up to some of our committees if we're not using this, because it is more of an expensive product, but those are clearly showing you the positive outcomes. On the next slide, we see culture, blood culture, skin preps. Again, here's another study published in Itchy in 2002, which shows a significant reduction in the rates of blood culture contamination. Again, you could link this up with the cost, because every time that we have a contaminated blood culture, it may cost us more money because of workups and even possible treatment by MDs with antibiotics when it wasn't necessary for that to happen. On the next slide shows you a chlorhexidine impregnated patch. This is a novel technology that's been on the market for a couple of years, produced by a company in the United States, and it is a concentrated chlorhexidine patch, which is used to put at sites when we're inserting catheters. What you see here is a central line, and it's recommended that this be placed over that insertion site, and it's used for up to 7 days. And as you see on the next slide, there is now quite an extensive amount of information and controlled trials based on this product. So if you were someone who were approached by a vendor in regard to this product, you can clearly see that there are controlled, randomized, multi-center trials which clearly show in a large number of patients a significant reduction in the number of catheter-related BSIs when you're using this product. So it may make, for example, an approval process certainly easier, and showing that this is very effective. On the next slide shows a cost-benefit analysis of this kind of dressing used. And for example, the results of this study show that the avoided cost for patients is anywhere from about $237 to almost $1,000 per patient. And nationally, they extrapolated, showing that if this is used for all patients on central lines, it may reduce the cost for medical facilities between $275 million to $1.97 billion per year. And maybe more important than anything else, it may reduce the number of patients dying by 3,900 in a year period. On the next slide shows you a large sterile drape. Under the CDC recommendations on preventing catheter-related bacteremias, one of the things that they advocate to use is using a large sterile drape when you're going to do a procedure on inserting a line. Now, they've never defined what is that size, but sometimes logic has to kind of come into play. If physicians do line insertions, for example, at bedside in a patient room, and even if they do them in a specific treatment room on a floor that is used for inserting lines of that type, or even if you're going to do this procedure in an operating room, it is logic that we need to isolate that area from the rest of the body, which has organisms on it, and that we need to use a drape that is going to be sufficient in size to cover those areas and create what we would call a sterile field. So we have to kind of follow the lead of what they do in the operating room in order to use a product like this. You'll notice, for example, on the next slide, that for our PACS here at Brookdale Medical Center, we had we purchased a drape that has a 4-inch opening. It has an adhesive around the edges of that opening, which would allow the adherence to the skin, not allow the drape to move around. And it is large enough in order to cover the patient in a large manner that would isolate that site from the rest of the patient's potential bacteria that they may have. You'll notice on the next slide that we have a photograph of what we call a universal central line catheter insertion set. I would always advocate people that when you're going to use, when you're going to try to standardize a procedure, the components of a procedure, such as inserting a central line, a PICC line, perhaps even an arterial line, that you provide the same things for all the physicians and those who insert lines in the institution so that they use the same exact thing. In this custom kit that we had made here, for example, you can see that it has the sterile gown, it has the gloves, it has the mask, it even has a cap, and in here it also has the drape. And on the next slide, you could see that it also has a tray that has the wound dressing components in it, and you could see at the bottom the chlorhexidine applicator and the different kinds of parts for the dressing. So what you do is you create a convenience for the staff. This should be distributed by your central services through every single floor, emergency departments, even the operating room. And they then will open this pack and have everything there for them instead of having the physician choose and then may perhaps making errors of not wearing this or not using that during the procedure, using a wrong antiseptic, things like that. Standardization, as we mentioned earlier, is a key component to trying to reduce hospital-acquired infections. On the next slide, you'll see the components for the dressing kit in a larger perspective as well. If you look at sterile barriers are actually very cost-effective. Here's a study from Clinical Infectious Disease 2004, lowered cost from $621 to $369 per catheter, and lowered the catheter-related BSI rates significantly, almost 50%, and even reduced mortality by 50% as well. If we have an understanding of how infections occur, on the next slide, here is a data from a study published by Dr. Mackey and colleagues, which shows the three ways in which an individual can acquire bacteria after they've had a catheter inserted. And this applies to all kinds of catheters, whether they're peripheral IV catheters or central lines, PIC lines, different kinds of non-tunnel catheters. Number one is where the skin organism invades and is brought in over the surface of the catheter itself, either at the time of doing the insertion or within the days after the insertion, where the bacteria migrates and colonizes on the outside of the catheter and migrates down on the surface of the catheter into the vein itself. Number two is where you have a contaminated catheter hub, where, for example, you may be introducing organisms through these different kinds of ports that the catheter hub of the catheter hub, where, for example, an individual may not have properly prepped that port prior to giving medications, etc. The third way is through contaminated infusate, and that is actually a fairly rare but used to be a very common way of having a person develop bacteremia. 20, 30 years ago, manufacturers did not have very good quality control, and we had outbreaks in the world where you already had organisms in, for example, IV fluids, and institutions would purchase them and directly be administering those organisms to the patient. What is the outcome of this study? The number one way of where skin that bacteremia develops is through the number one route. 60% of all infections or bacteremias occur in that route. 12% occur in route number two, and about 1% occur in the third route. So what does that really tell us? Is that we have to put our efforts in preventing infection into particularly route number one. So let's take a look a little bit about how that might be affected. When we look at dressings are extremely important. And one of the things that I always advocate is that infection control professionals should be looking at the condition of dressings, for example, dressings on catheter lines, to making sure that they are intact, particularly in the days after initial insertion. Because once it starts to peel away and the site is exposed, we might as well not be using any of these dressings. And in particularly for those institutions that use these high perm, high-tech dressings that have the transparent windows on the surface so we can take a look at those sites. Once that dressing is peeled, then there really is no effect to try to have, there's no need to have these kinds of dressings if we're not going to be very good at making sure that they're used properly. Here's a study that we conducted at the University, Brookdale University Medical Center, comparing two different dressings, and you can clearly see the percent of peeled dressings for two different products over about 1 year's worth of observation in each. About 50% of all the dressings that were observed in product A were peeling. as opposed to product B, about 13. And it may have been some factor in whether catheter-related BSI actually occurred. You'll notice that in product B, three times less catheter-related bacteremia occurred than in when we were using product A. Here in the next slide is a sample of a dressing that we are currently using. Again, we have to ensure that if we're going to use the transparent dressings, that they're going to adhere properly. And we use one particularly that is better anatomically suited for people who have internal jugular insertions when we're using central lines, so that adheres better to the anatomy and has less risk of coming off. The next slide shows us the issue of needleless IV connectors, and this seems to have become a very big issue in the United States and has been widely discussed about the probability of whether these needleless connectors are associated with higher rates of contamination and eventually, of course, of causing bacteremia. There are many, many, many different needleless connectors on the market today. The original purpose of the needleless connector is really to avoid nursing staff, particularly, from using needles accessing different IV ports, because obviously they're associated with increased rates of needle stick injuries. Now, many of these devices are what we call positive displacement, where once they're accessed, essentially they have some an internal mechanism of a valve where they essentially flush the contents of that of what you've essentially put in, the medication, et cetera, so that it does not have a pool of liquid inside, in other words, to create a niche for bacteria to grow. Unfortunately, some of these are better designed than others, and on the next slide you can clearly see that there are studies now that show in vitro studies indicating no increased contamination. Many of these, again, have been presented at different conferences, have been published in the literature. But if you look at the next slide then, some are in vitro, in vivo studies indicating no increased contamination or infection. And on the next slide, reports of possible contamination or infection with use of needleless injection caps. So essentially, it's kind of an issue kind of in limbo. One of the things is that we don't really know what some of these devices may be, whether they may be adding to the increased bacteremia. But if you're considering using them, one of the things we need to do is carefully evaluate them, monitoring whether we have increased rates of positive blood cultures among these patients that are using these kinds of needleless devices. I know Dr. William Jarvis is going to be presenting another lecture at this year's Infection Control Conference in Tampa, Florida in June. And those of you attending may want to go to hear him talk a little bit more about this issue. One of the things the reports indicate is the lack of improper compliance, really, with disinfecting the connector ports. For example, one of the standards is to use things such as alcohol to wipe the port prior to giving any medication. And a number of these studies shows that some of those kinds of practices were not being done very effectively, or sometimes they were not done at all, and therefore this may have added to some of that issue of increased contamination. Other products on the market, for example, that are available are antiseptic barrier caps, which are now, I believe, now being studied and may be coming to market very soon. What this product does essentially is contain a sponge filled with chlorhexidine, and that you merely screw these little caps onto the ports of the IVs in order to give them continuous contact with chlorhexidine. Now, does this work? Well, on the next slide, you'll see that information presented at one of the APIC conferences shows that that the product has quite a bit of evidence that they may simply reduce the growth of any kind of bacteria that might have been introduced at the time that medication or other drugs might have been added to the system. So it looks promising. Again, we have to then weigh how much this costs, the benefit to the patient, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let's take a look at a little bit about what we call incremental cost. At the Brookdale University Medical Center, what we did was we tried to look at how much additional monies we were spending for some of the innovations that we tried to do when we implemented the prevention of catheter-related bacteremia program that we instituted here a number of years ago. If you'll notice on the first, on the second row, where it says maximal sterile barrier kit, as I showed you pictures before, the incremental cost to the institution was $7 per kit. We estimated that in 10 days of use, you'd use two of those kits, so therefore, the additional cost to the institution would be $14. And you'll see on the different rows different items that we had introduced. So, for example, where we went to a 70% alcohol, 2% CHG product on the market here in the United States for skin antiseptic, that cost us an addition about $1.40 over a 10-day use for a patient. So roughly, I have to tell you, I have a miscalculation here because at the last row, 2 times 10 should be 20. And yes, in the United States, we do still remember how to do our math, and I apologize for that error. But let's just say roughly that the incremental cost was about $50. On the next slide, what we did was we tried to show that originally when we had looked at the number of infections that occurred, the catheter-related bacteremias that occur at an infection rate of about 10%, we were looking at about 84 infections occurring per year. And the total attributable infection cost for that was about $3.8 million. And that was calculated from a CDC figure of about $45,000 per catheter-related infection. Now, if you bear with me, let's jump down to the 5% infection rate. What we could expect at this particular institution is that if we reduced our infection rate down to 5%, we would cut our infection rate by half, so it would be 42. And therefore, our infection rates itself, our cost for the total attributable infection cost would be about $1.9 million. Now, go across the row and take a look at our incremental intervention cost, which was $39,860. What that number is the total amount of dollars spent by the institution for the additional technology that we introduced. So in other words, what we did was we subtracted that from the $1.9 million figure to come down with a total avoided cost of about $1,860,000. So the number of times that infection costs are greater than the intervention cost by reducing it down to 5% is 47 times as much. So in other words, what I'm really trying to say here is that even though technology is more expensive, if you eliminate even just, let's say, 2, 3, 4% of your infection, you're more than paying for the cost of that incremental cost for the new products. Okay, let's take a look about safety sharps. Let's not read the entire list here about what is required, but in the United States, there are organizations which give us guidance as to how we should select a safety sharp item. And this is a requirement, a federal requirement under the OSHA Bloodborne Pathogen Regulation, which was updated in the year 2000 to mandate that all healthcare facilities must provide safety engineered sharps devices for use in medical facilities. And here's a list of the criteria which has been, published by these organizations. One of the things that we need to do is on current trends and assessment of needle sticks in the institution, is you need to identify what are some of those trends, because if we're going to be changing to a safety sharp item, and this, again, is for protection of the employee, we need to really identify particularly what are those devices that are being associated with the greatest number of injuries and at what phases that they occur in. In other words, did they occur at the time when the employee finished using the device, and if they had a safety device at that time, they could have closed it, locked it, et cetera, before disposal so they would not be injured. One of the most important things when we're talking about product evaluation of safety sharps is ease of use. If the employee does not find the safety sharp to be easy to use, what we would say here is a no-brainer. The chances are that it's not going to be very well accepted, and it's not going to be used very well, and therefore what? It's not going to really reduce the number of needle stick injuries that we have. All right, let's kind of go on here. The next slide, you see a picture of two different kinds of insulin syringes that are used. Now, here at the institution, what we looked at was what was our problem. If the first device that you see, product A at the top, was a device that we used to use here in the facility. And unfortunately, it was not a very intuitive product to use. And we had a number of injuries because some employees felt that it looked like when you slid the handle up in order to slide over the needle to lock it, that you could put your thumb on top of the device in order to do that. And unfortunately, we had a number of injuries because the device would not lock, and inadvertently the employee would push the top down, and it wasn't locked, and their finger would go right into the needle. At the bottom is a device that we chose and we evaluated to replace the initial product. And take a look at the graph on the next slide that talks about insulin syringes. And don't forget, insulin syringes is one of the most widely used of devices in any medical facility because of the large number of patients that are insulin dependent. Take a look at the first quarter of 2005. We had introduced product B in 2004 up to the data that I have here in March of 2005, where we had only two needle sticks since conversion to using a new insulin syringe. So it had a dramatic effect in terms of the injuries that we had to employees. On the next slide, you'll see the evaluation results. And this is evaluations that we did in over 500 employees in the institution. And you can see the listed medical units, the total number of responses, and who and what did they do, for example, based on a series of questions. And this question here in this example is, I would recommend that this product be purchased by the facility. And this is the way that I think that generally evaluations should be conducted for almost any product, because what you can do then is get a true sense from the rank and file, from those front-end users, as to whether the product that you want to introduce is better than what you're using, and does it, and is it their feeling that it would improve safety throughout the organization. Take a look at the next slide. These are safety butterflies. And on the left, excuse me, you have a model that we used to use here that unfortunately you see by the circles has two deficiencies, and these were identified by a long series of trend analysis in the institution here over a number of years. One of the things that you can see on the left-hand side is that there is a needle attached at the end of this butterfly, but that there is no cover to it in terms of having a direct vacutainer attached directly to the product when you open the package. And on the right-hand side, under the other circle, the yellow piece that is the sliding mechanism over the needle was rather difficult to use. And butterflies is one of the more difficult needle devices to use only because it is so flexible. On the right-hand side, you'll see, is the product that we eventually went to use that has, number one, a better device for sliding with your thumb in order to cover the main needle that goes into the patient. And on the right-hand side, you'll notice it comes already attached with a vacutainer holder which covers the other needle in which you would put the tubes into. Take a look clearly on the butterfly-related sharps injury. What you can see here is that did product B assist us in reducing sharps injuries? And see in the different time frames that essentially it did not. And strange enough, you say to yourself, okay, you have improved technology, but it did not. So what was the answer here? I think the answer here was one of behavior issues, and that we still have a long ways to go to get a better technology device that is easier to close, more intuitive in nature. And yet, when we started to use this product and do evaluation, we showed that it really had very little effect in terms of reducing our needle sticks. One of the resources that I think that people should use when you're looking at doing sharps evaluation is a publication by ECRI. And you could go to ECRI.com, and you could get this edition of their Sharp Safety and Needle Stick Prevention manual, which is very, very good. And it gives you many steps on how to do an evaluation. It gives you many products on the market. And it gives you a comparative guide between different products on the market. And I think it would be very useful for anybody establishing a program or updating their programs. Let's see what else we can get through before we run out of time here. I'm going to skip over a couple of slides and emphasize one. You'll see a photograph of a kit. This is a Centraline kit that has a number of needles and sharps devices. Again, infection control needs to get involved to try to identify, for example, purchase kits that have sharps devices within them. So we may be making decisions on individual items, for example, safety syringes that we purchase for general use, but we may be neglecting those items that are within kits that physicians are using for procedures, and we also need to enhance the safety of those products. On the next slide, you'll see a listing, for example, that we use here in our institution, where we've made it fairly simple. We've put in a device category, the device that we currently use, and the ECRI rating that is from the manual that I had mentioned to you before. And we have it as a one-page handout with our policies in the institution that makes it very convenient for the institution to see what we're using, what is used in the institution, and also for the regulators as well. Okay, I'm going to skip over a little bit about sharps disposal containers, although you can see that outsourcing is a very effective way to go to avoid employees themselves removing needle boxes. This is the issue of contracting with outside services to do that as well. Well, I don't know if we're going to have time to look at preventing ventilator-associated pneumonia, but I will mention to you that there is a vast amount of information today about the issue of associating oral and dental colonization with bacteria and the outcome of respiratory infection. And recently I published an article in the American Journal of Infection Control on that issue. I believe it came out at the end of last year, which shows you, I think, some very strong evidence on linking those two to the outcome of respiratory infection, and in particular, for example, of the avoidance of ventilator-associated pneumonia. One of the things that we have tried to do here at the Brookdale University Medical Center is to use, for example, the tools which have assisted us in reducing the colonization to patients. And you'll notice on one of the slides that there are additional photographs which kind of outline the oral and dental care system that we use here, and that it's been very, very effective in reducing the outcome of ventilator-associated pneumonia. If you see from the graph on the handout, it says VAP rates MICU, which is our medical ICU. We've been doing a study now here for about 4 years on this issue, where we have a pre-intervention period and a post-intervention period, and it clearly shows you that we've reduced our ventilator-associated pneumonia rate by about 40 to 50% when we address the issue of reducing colonization in the mouth. So these are very effective, and we know that VAP can be very expensive and cost the institution a lot more money than what we're spending on products. I believe that what we'll do here is, I don't think that we really have a lot more time. I think the rest of the slides are self-explanatory. I think if we have time, maybe we'll open it up for questions.
Yeah.
And I thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Can I just have a very quick question? I'm very interested in how you managed to get your physicians to comply with this standardization. It's a problem we have in the UK about physicians always wanting to do things their own way. Was it a real burden, a real sort of mountain to climb?
Sure, that is a difficult process, and a lot of times you have physicians, for example, that are, I guess, within their own little kingdoms, if you do want to call it that. And they involve many different groups, surgeons, for example, orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeons. We have you know, chiefs of medical ICUs and surgical ICUs. What I think you need to do is have a very proactive kind of stance, is try to get those physicians that are involved in any kind of process. For example, if you're talking about preventing VAP, sit down with those pulmonary specialists. Get them all in the room. Be very proactive. Get a lot of the information, the data, the studies, and say, look, here are a lot of the interventions that have worked in other facilities, and here are some of the guidelines that are published. How can we start trying to do a preventive program? Here are some of our base data for the institution. Here is the data converted to dollars to show you how much it's costing the institution in terms of infection. I mean, certainly one of the most important people to get is to try to get administrative support.
Mm-hmm.
The administrators that oversee the physician practices need to get involved, and they have to have an understanding that these things are very negative for patients, and obviously that there are patients who die as a result of these infections, and that also that it costs a great deal of money.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We actually have run out of time now, Robert, so I'm going to have to thank you very much for the excellent presentation. It's been extremely challenging.
Thank you, Maria. I appreciate it. If anybody would like any other questions, you could certainly email me. My email is on the last slide, I believe, or next to last slide.
That's great.
I'll be very happy to answer.
Or alternatively, if they want to email me, I can forward them on to you. So can
very
I
good.
Thank you very much for the thought-provoking presentation that you've given to us. And I think it certainly has a lot of challenges ahead for us over here in the UK.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
And thank you very much.
Yes,
again.
Thank you so much.
And it's been really good to speak to you.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah. Be well.
Cheers. Goodbye.